Today is August 28th, 1991. The time is 3 o'clock. City Assessor Terry Herron and Community Development Director Timothy Moore will now discuss the history of the North End project for this tape. The occasion of this discussion is an introduction of new commission members, and this history will familiarize them with the project.
You want to record this for history?
Sure. So, anyhow, we were just talking about general city stuff. We just had gotten stuff. Anyhow, the problem was the people up there did not want to band together into a unified group. They wanted to be free to make their own situation. And basically, the city was not interested in having a group of fractured developments, small retail or what have you, office developments. We wanted to see a more unified situation. But the opportunity really never presented itself. And Tim, what happened before TIFA? There was, like, if you go back in the prehistory here, there were several.
It dates back to the early 1960s. It had been a deteriorated and rundown area, 75 to 85 houses, depending on what point in time we were talking about. And it was so bad that the city, in fact, with the assistance of a citizens advisory committee, it's called our CACCI, pushed to get the city involved in urban renewal funding to demolish the area and start over. In fact, that got started. A grant was approved by the federal government. It did get started. We did appraisals of all the property. And it was moving along nicely. And about that time, they were starting to construct the Oakland Mall. And the a lot of the residents up there were not at all pleased with the city coming in and buying their property. And they were even further displeased when the Oakland Mall came along, because they had visions of another Northland where the land values would skyrocket around this Oakland Mall building center. So anyway, to make a long story short, they pressured the city council at the time into terminating the project, and it was terminated. And the money, in effect, was given back to the federal government, and they were told...
Okay, this is an era of time of the 1960s?
This was probably about 1966, 67, right in there. Soon thereafter, they started saying, well, look, we realize that this is going to be a business or office area. We want some type of zoning that will allow us to go to live as residents until a business opportunity comes along, and then for us to be able to sell our property. And they wanted their cake and to be able to eat it too. So the city came up with a transitional zoning, which was modeled after a zoning ordinance from somewhere out in Denver, Colorado. And the transitional zoning allowed them to keep their houses. The houses were legal uses. However, they could not expand the houses. They could maintain them, but they could not expand them. And the idea was to gradually transcend from the residential uses into a business or office use. That zoning was in place from about 1960, I'll say 67, until...
86.
The mid-1980s, late 86, 87, right in there.
87 when it changed.
Mm-hmm. And there were many, the residents frequently would make accusations against the city and say, well, the city is punishing us. They won't let us develop there. Every time an interested party goes to City Hall, they are discouraged by those in City Hall, and they're not allowed to develop, etc., etc. The people, that's not the case, however. The people who came in looking for interest about developing in the area were just told what the ordinance said. The ordinance says you've got to have setbacks of so many feet. You can only build so much building. You have to have so many parking places and so forth. They were given these facts. Those weren't really discouraging. What was discouraging for these folks, and they didn't want to really tell that to the various residents is that whenever you're dealing with a large group of people, and you've got to have at least a significant number of them together, working together in order to come up with a viable project of an area large enough to do something with, you're asking for a lot. Because, you know, even to get five people to agree on one thing, let alone 30 or 40 or 50 or 100, that was the real problem, was trying to get the people to agree on, well, I agree to sell my property for this, you agree to sell it for this, you agree to sell it for that, and then throw all that together and have one price, one asking price for one usable chunk of property. However, they wouldn't do that. They were afraid to give a price because they were afraid the guy next door might get $2 more. And the end result was they could never do that.
It sat there.
There would be a piece of property here, and maybe one over there for sale, and one over there for sale. But nobody could really pull it together. The people could not agree. The only successes, now originally this transitional area went from Whitcomb all the way to 14 Mile Road. The 14 Mile frontage did have some development here in the first block, the north end of Shell Station, and that old block of buildings up there where the Radiator place is located. That was pre-existing. That was there at the time the project started. The frontage on the next three blocks, however, that's where your first development occurred. Along about 1968, Chrysler came in and bought up that whole block. That's the block right here. And they put their dealership there. A little bit later, along comes Ollie Fretter and
Denny's and all those.
No, the restaurant.
Beef Eater.
Okay.
Beef Carver, whatever they call it. And those pretty well sealed off the 14 mile frontage. That's what we were attempting to preclude, was to not have the frontage sealed off. That happened early on, and before 1970. We were really concerned that was going to happen come down John R. And in effect, you'd have strip commercial, and the rest of it would be dead. There's no way to get to it.
Just be
closed off.
A downtrodden rental residential area, locked off from any.
Yeah. So, we worked with whoever came in. We tried to get different development to occur. The only success that we had in the late 70s, early 80s was when Shostak Brothers came in. We threw the whole problem out to them and said, here, you know, this area is not getting any better, it's getting worse, and we know it has potential, and we gave them the whole scenario, we helped them, and they were able to put together one project, and that is the rest of this block, or most of the rest of this block, here someplace, and down here.
It's Motel 6 now.
Where the motel is.
Yeah.
Okay. They were attempting to work with some of the other property owners, but they just never were able to do it.
Yeah.
That gets us into the 1980s, and then we approached Sam Frankel.
Did we approach him, or did he come to us?
Sam Frankel. Let me explain now. Sam Frankel and Stuart Frankel are, Sam is the father and Stuart is the son. We approached Sam along about the same time that we did Shostak, and we said, can you do anything? And Sam really just wasn't interested. He thought it was too large an undertaking, and he didn't think it was going to be successful, and he kind of walked away from it. Shostak, as I said, was successful to a limited extent. They did work a lot in the area, but that was the only actual project they could put together. Then along about 1984, we've got it written down someplace.
Yeah, it's 84, I know.
Yeah, 84. Stuart Frankel was doing a building up on 14 Mile Road.
Commerce Commons or whatever it is.
Yeah, something like
the
that.
The white office building where EDS used to be.
Where EDS was.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
It was about a 65,000 square foot, 68,000 square foot building.
Yeah.
He built that building, and that building was rolling along nearing completion, and one day he asked me if I wanted to go to lunch. He had he wanted to talk about that, he had some questions about that building. I said, okay. Which was unusual because Stuart doesn't throw his money around. He doesn't buy lunch very often. Anyway, so we went to lunch and we talked about his building on 14 Mile Road. And then he says, well, what other opportunities do you have? Other development here in town? What other things could we make happen? So I said, well, got nothing to lose. So I just dumped the whole thing out, this whole scenario on him. I told him about the whole area and I said, we think it's got potential because of where it's at. And the fact that it's got major streets on three sides of it, and it's crossing the open mall, and near I-75, and all went through the whole bit. But I said it's very, very difficult, and I went over the whole history with him. Well, if you know Stuart, he likes a challenge. And Stuart took a hold of it, and he just kept ramming into it until we started to make some things happen. He was immediately interested, and he and we really didn't know how the whole thing was going to work out, and it was kind of a trial and error situation, wherein originally we, the city, were going to, let's go back a little bit further. We discussed at some length, and please fill in the things that I forget. We discussed at some length this whole project and what the limits of the project should be and what might happen there in terms of uses, office and business and so on and so forth. And Stuart came up with a preliminary sketch of the front portion being retail and the back portion all being office. Okay, because office at that time was doing quite well.
Yeah,
that was the mid 80s. So we got enough information put together that we said, well, now's the time to approach the city council with this whole thing and to see whether they're interested in supporting this whole thing, because if they're not interested, we might as well just forget it. So a presentation was put together for city council, given to council, and by and large, I think most of the members of the council liked the whole proposal. It was suggested to council, and council went along with it, that maybe, in fact, even council came up with the idea, maybe one of the members, that we have a vote of the residents of the area to see how they feel about it, to see whether they're willing to go along with this.
Which we did.
It was, in fact, a vote.
Just the people that lived within the
correct.
Property? No, all property owners, whether they lived there or not.
No. Yeah.
Whether they lived in the area or not, there was a lot of absentee.
Oh yeah, absentee.
Any property.
Right, but we categorized them separately. We counted residents, and then we had property owners. All property owners had two counts, so to speak, because council basically felt that the residents were more important in their opinions than the absentee landowners. So council wanted to know that each category to vote. So a vote was actually held. Ballots were sent out to the people, and there was a vote held here in City Hall. City clerk served as an election official,
yeah.
And we had a board of the residents up there who were to certify the vote, that and to watch over things to make sure there wasn't any shenanigans and it was counted honestly and so on and so forth. And the end result was approximately a 2-1. Vote in favor of the project when you take both the
absentees
and the residents. Now among residents themselves, it was about slight advantage, wasn't it?
So there was a very slight advantage
to going in. The project. But just the residents.
There was 120 separate owners, 70 residents, so it was very close. With I can't remember, but nevertheless, the majority did want to go, so that was a signal to council that we have a majority here,
right.
I think.
Right. So the vote was taken. It was a mandate to move ahead. Council, in fact, realizing that it meant possibly having to condemn property, because you can't make 100 and some odd people all happy.
Yeah.
They realized that, but they did vote to move ahead with the project. Originally, the concept was for us, the city, to acquire the property. And then and then turn it over to Stuart Frankel. That worked for a little while. But no, wait a minute, I'm sorry. Let me back up. I've got that backwards. Originally, the project was for Stuart Frankel to acquire the property, and he, in fact, hired a property acquisition agent, somebody who had done a number of these projects. Her name was Drew Diedrich, and her mother, who operated a real estate firm in Southfield. They'd been experienced at assembling projects like this and then ending up with a unified development. He hired them. They began, offers were sent out to all of the property owners offering to buy the property for X number of dollars. And appraisals, of course, were done.
We
hired a certified appraiser.
You didn't do the appraisal.
No.
I didn't really want to, because it could have been construed as a conflict of interest. I mean, here I am, the city, setting value on the property that the city wants.
Yeah.
So this was a... Before that, though, Tim, what happened up here was, when we decided to get going with it, we had to have some agreement with the school district, because the only program available to do something like this and have condemnation powers was a TIFA, Tax Increment Finance Authority. And in those days, in the mid-80s, in 86, 85, school districts all over Michigan were suing cities and TIFAs because they felt that the revenue diverted to pay for this thing was rightfully voted to finance the education of children. And what we decided to do before we went much further was to sit down with the school board administration and ultimately the school board elected folks and make certain that if we just came up with a project which would, we wouldn't get cute with it, in other words, we'd do the deal and get out, that there would be no lawsuit, because that would have killed it. So there was a luncheon meeting at one time, remember that, with Frank Agnello and who was the controller then?
Bob, him.
And, but anyways, and I think one of our elected officials and one of your, maybe the president of the school board at that time, whoever that may have been.
Bob Vorngesser
was on the school board.
The school
controller.
Board, the controller was Bob.
I don't know. I can't. Anyway.
He moved to Tennessee.
Yeah.
He retired, moved out to Tennessee. But as a result of it, there was an agreement made that if we just did what we said we would do, use it to condemn. See, a lot of what happened was a lot of cities and townships were taking this money and then building roads with it and doing a lot of other things unallied with development, and it just spread beyond. But anyways, there was an agreement that there would be no lawsuit. So then we moved ahead with this thing. And then there was a dinner. You remember that?
Yeah.
That we all got beat up in the paper for. Remember the big dinner where Stuart unveiled a plan, I think, to develop this? And after that, we incorporated, I think, in 1986, in mid-86, at Tax Increment Finance. I think the EDC voted the money to fund the plan,
fund the TIFA.
Yeah.
And we did incorporate a TIFA, and at that time, Drew Diedrich was buying property.
And, of course, one of the problems we had was lack of front money. We didn't have money to start acquiring property.
So
we talked about the possibility of... Stuart was already interested in the property that was owned by the school district across on the south side of Wickham.
What was it? 6 acres?
16.
16 acres.
And he was interested in it, but then we said, well, look, we start talking with the school board. What happens if Stuart buys the property from us, okay? You sell it to us to start with. You sell it to the city, and with a zero or minimal down payment, and payment to occur within a certain time frame.
What's up, the school property?
School property.
Yeah.
We entered
a land contract arrangement.
Right.
With the...
Anyway, the end result was that we ended up, after Stuart acquired the property, we ended up with $1 million or $1.5 million with which to use to start acquiring property. Okay? And we did
it. Now, that $1.5 million came from Stewart, didn't it?
Originally, yeah. He paid the school district. He paid us after the school district transferred the property to us.
Yeah. Right.
So it really was a... What was unusual about the whole thing, and if we ever write it up, this is one of the things I think we have to stress, is the fact that there was this cooperative effort between the various agencies.
The government, the school district,
the city, and the developer working together to make it happen. And any one of the players could have stopped it from happening by just being stubborn. But everybody worked toward it happening, and I think the end result is the financial betterment of the city, the school district, and the developer.
And I
have to say this too, just in retrospect, while not all of the people who we acquired property from in the area were 100% happy, or even today are 100% happy, most were. And I would say that just about almost without exception, the people were better off for the move. And they were able to, with the monies that were paid them, they were able to improve upon their circumstances, in some cases 2 and 3 times better than what they had.
I think we started buying property right around the beginning, January of 86, and we were all done by the end of the year. It took us a year to buy the property, and there was only, I think, 13 people out of the 120 owners that we couldn't, in the end, deal with. We ultimately ended up condemning them and paying them the appraised value.
Now, that's 13. I think we're down to 10 now.
Now we're down to 10 in the interim.
In other words, you only had to condemn 13 parcels of property?
10 to 13, because what happens, we may have started condemning 13, but a couple of them settled the condemnation process. So the end result is that we are now still litigating or waiting for a very slow judge to give us an answer on 10 owners.
10, right. And that's still up in the air. Although I understand now what they've decided to do is they're seating them like a special master's board of legal professionals and appraisers that have prior experience in condemnation. And they will make a judgment as to whether the offer that these people got was satisfactory, and they will come up with a value, you know, and award that. Ultimately, it could amount, if these people get what they're asking for, and it's kind of outrageous, would be an additional $1.4 million. But that's
really
Stewart's. That's not ours.
We don't really feel too unhappy about the whole scenario, because I think, as I said, most people were paid and paid well for their property.
They never would.
In fact, they were given sometimes twice what the appraised value was.
Yeah. To get them.
And I think that the judges recognized that and seemed to be duly impressed.
We appraised those. The appraisers that were hired were told to appraise the property as if it was in saleable condition, average saleable condition. Some of that property up there was so bad, you never would have been able to sell it through a bank. It would have had gone through a land contract, because no bank would have loaned money. Matter of fact, I think the second guy that we dealt with was on the bottom end of 3 land contracts over a deed holder, because, you know, the owner sold it to one guy, and then this guy sold on a land contract to the next one, and this one to the next one, Timothy Chin, and it was a piggyback of land contracts. So when we had and then the original owner still had a mortgage. When we had the closing, we were dealing with these 3 families, the original deed holder, and the bank. What a mess. But there were a lot of odd situations like that, since the property was so run down. But these people were paid as if it was a regular subdivision home in average condition, and they never would have got that. Plus, they were each received, I think, $9,000 for relocation costs, which was mandated, I think, by the federal government guidelines. So they got that.
I think they went as far as paying paid their moving expense, and also paid money for the kids to go to school that would cost them extra. They paid that.
Yeah.
I mean, they paid and paid and paid. So they really, you know.
But I'll tell you, the whole thing. You know what the cost of commercial land is? It's like industrial is $350 a square foot. This whole thing was assembled for $2.90 a square foot.
Right.
It was a damn good assembly.
That was a problem. They wanted that kind of money.
But they wanted to be paid as if it was commercial property, not residential.
Yeah.
And until it was all assembled, it wasn't commercial property, because as these little fractured entities, it wasn't worth that much, which is the crux of all this argument here today.
Mm-hmm.
But by the end of 86, we had all of... By the beginning of 87, I think the... We got title, wasn't it February or March of 87, we got title to the property. We arranged to have all those homes knocked down and bulldozed, and the property put in a condition to build. And then Stuart Frankel took over, and I think Target bought a piece, sold a piece off to Target in the bottom.
Target actually bought this piece down here where their store is sitting.
Yeah.
Mervyn's actually bought the pad that they're sitting on, and the theater in the back is a long-term lease from Stuart to local
land
theaters.
Lease. Mm-hmm.
Land lease. The rest of it, including the theater, is still owned by Stuart. We have a parcel down here in the corner, about a 3-acre parcel right down there in the corner, that is still open for development. It's the area that's not mowed down there. And then across the street, we've got a 4-acre vacant parcel where they just finished taking that big pile of topsoil off there.
Across Whitcomb.
Across Whitcomb.
So
south side
south.
Of Whitcomb. Yeah. Yeah. And then, in addition, we also have the vacant 100,000 square foot pad. It's not shown on any of these drawings here, but on the south side of Whitcomb, that will make up the rest of the court where Madison Court is. Madison Court right now consists of one east-west building. Now we have an additional L-shaped building of 100,000 feet. The pad is already there. In other words, they've already got the drainage is in, the base is in. They've got the parking lot paved around it, and it's just a matter of putting their footings in and paving their building.
Is that Stuart Frankel also?
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
All that's Stuart Frankel. Everything is Stuart Frankel.
Yeah.
Now, let me ask you something. Okay. Finally, this went through, and you said this is like, you know, 87.
Mm-hmm.
So now, where this parcel of property, now the city has no revenue coming in from taxes, right?
No, that's not true.
We did. We had revenue. Originally, when the homes were there, the total assessments were about $1.3 million. Out of this whole area
which
here.
Which meant dollars to the city.
Of about, it was total $70,000 in taxes, and dollars to the city was $22,000. That's all the city got. The school district probably got about 47 or 48.
Right. That's before the project started.
Yeah. We
now,
always had that.
As of just prior to the bond sale, we had what? How many million?
This past year, 16 million in assessments. And the total revenue coming over off of it is over $800,000.
$800,000.
And even with the bond payments of $650,000 a year, whatever that, there's still $200,000 left over, and that's only for what's there. If he builds anything else, that provides more.
But was there an interim of time the city and the schools didn't receive any money for that?
No, never.
No, we always received at least
because
what was
the
there.
Property always had an owner.
It was always on the tax rolls. The city would own it for a period of time. I think we gave the property to Stuart on three different deeds over a period of time, so that it was never in public hands on tax day. We didn't want it in public hands on December 31st. So we'd sell it to him for the amount he paid to acquire it. And anyway, at that particular
so
point.
So I guess the interesting thing, and that's one of the things that we told the school district early on, was that you'll never receive less than what you're receiving now, and ultimately you'll receive a whole lot more if this happens.
Because they were worried about that very
thing. And in fact, they never did receive less than, in fact, even now, even with the bond payments, their revenue is probably three times what it was. And every successive building, he's still got some capacity there for some more buildings.
Yeah.
And that will improve upon the situation dramatically.
At one time, he also, there was a proposal putting a high-rise in
there. Hotel.
Hotel.
And that's what the 4-acre parcel is on the south side, right in front of the school bus garage.
Okay.
It's they, a reserve.
It's kind of reserved for a hotel. However, hotels are kind of a dead issue right now. Nobody's building hotels.
You know. That's on a hold.
That's on a hold, and he's not real anxious. One thing about Stuart, he could have filled these buildings many times with lesser quality companies, lower bond ratings. They come in, anybody that could pay his rent, okay? But he didn't. He held out for long-term, well-rated AAA companies in some instances. And he's saying, look, I want this to be for the long haul. I want good quality, and I'm not going to put somebody in there that I'm going to be embarrassed about or that the city's going to be embarrassed about. Mm-hmm. So he has only put in good, firm companies. And as of right now, there has not been a single business that has gone in there and then gone back out again, which is very unusual, because anytime you have a shopping center, there's always a turnover.
Yeah, sure.
And
he waits.
He waits, and that's why he's waiting. He didn't build that other 100,000 square footer to complete the rest of the Madison Court on the south side of Whitcomb. Nor has he built anything about a hotel. Nor has he built the office building down here in this corner or any other use down in that corner, because it's just not right.
Yeah.
He's been able to do that because he was successful in selling this piece and selling this piece. That got him out of the box. You know, he was paying millions and millions of dollars in borrowed funds. By selling those, he was able to recoup a lot of his monies, get his payments down where it was now affordable for him to wait until the right uses came along.
So, well, it's like everything else. I think the long-term lease on that and the selling prices of these two things probably got him almost even with what he put out in the first place. He doesn't have much money in it. That's how they work, these guys. But anyway, as far as our TIFA board's consideration with it and these bonds that we voted on, how that relates is that we had agreed. There was, originally when we started out with Stuart, there had to be an agreement. And there was an agreement between City Council, TIFA, and Stuart Frankel, that we would all do certain things. And one of the things we promised to do, we basically promised to condemn property that what he wasn't able to acquire. I mean, that had to be. That's the reason we went with the TIFA. We also promised to reimburse him for public infrastructure and allied costs. In other words, anything the city would eventually own, the cost to him to put it in, or any public access or right-of-way through the property, we would reimburse him for. Basically, then, after he got his development set and was essentially in the same shape you see now, which happened between 87 and 91, basically when it got to that particular shape, he was done with his costs. He was able to quantify it. And then
he said, I want to go and sell.
And we had said we would sell up but not past $5 million in bonds. This is a this project, when it's all done, will probably be somewhere around a 40 some odd million dollar shopping center project. We promised to pay no more than five. We just completed the bond sale for $4,675,000. He did submit a list of costs. We did hire Plante Moran,
our
city auditors, to go and verify that, in fact, the costs that he submitted were actual costs that were dealt with that. They went back through his books and checkbooks and verified things, or what have you, gave us an opinion to that effect. I think the engineer, our city engineer, verified the quantities used to arrive at the monies. And based on that, we sold the bonds. That's how that was. We were fulfilling part of a contract that was entered into probably back in early 86 between Madison Heights.
Okay, the bonds, the payments are for how many years?
Payments are 10 years. It's a 10-year TIFA bond.
At a constant...
I think they sold them, 9.1%. Something going out to the board shortly when we get everything update on how much. On top of that, since it's TIFA's responsibility to, for the rest of these condemnations, we withheld $1.4 million from him of the bond proceeds. So in other words, we sold the $4,675,765,000 worth of these things, but he only got, by the time we were done, because he owed us around $200,000.
He owed us some expenses that we had incurred that were his responsibility, and we deducted the amount that we were potentially liable for on the court settlements. Deducted those things, and his net take home was only
$2,950,000 or something is what he walked away with after everybody, you know, reserved what they had to. We had to pay bond counsel and all this other business. But that was the reason we voted on those bonds, was because it came time to reimburse them for the infrastructure costs. They were legitimate costs. We sold them. Now the tax revenue from this project gets diverted. Well, $650,000 or portion of it gets diverted to pay him back over a 10-year stretch. Any growth in here, like if he puts that office building in, if he puts in the other 100,000 square feet of retail on the south side, retail office on the south side of Whitcomb, you know, like where CompUSA is and all those stores, there's two more buildings, or an L-shaped building that goes around, which is another 100,000. Plus, if he ever does build a hotel or whatever finally goes on that backtrack, that's over and above. When we calculated how much...
In other words, that total amount is would go to the taxing jurisdictions. It would not be... no further payments would go to him.
See, like now, we get about $800,000 in revenue. There's about a $600,000 bond payment, so we have $200,000 left. That $200,000, Lamphere will end up with 58% of it. We'll end up with 25% of it. The county will end up whatever their percentage is. We'll pass that much back through every single year.
Tax distribution,
right?
Yeah, that's based on, you know, we take your millage rate as a percentage of the total, and that's how we get it. Once the bonds are paid off, then it all. What we'll do is we'll fold the TIF. We'll just disincorporate, if you will.
Well, that won't be though.
For 10 more, 2002.
2002.
Yeah. But that's all that our TIFA was designed to do. I know in other cities, and what got them into trouble with school districts and counties, other millage-levying bodies, was they tried to say, okay, golly, you know, we built this project, but we need to replace John R. Road now. Let's widen this road. And they would capture more money from it, funnel it into something else. And then finally, it got so far away from what it's... Now TIFAs are illegal. There's no such thing as a TIFA. There's what they call a LIDFIL, the FA Local Development Finance Authority, which is a constitutional... It's been cleaned up a little bit. And it gives other millage levying bodies a direct vote in things. TIFA didn't. Like the school district or the county who loses tax money had no real direct vote. Except in our situation... What we did was appoint school board members
board. You immediately had two members on it. You had Danny Parisi and Bob Horngesser on it.
Well, that was basically to get away from... you know what it was.
Sure. Another nice thing, too. Let's face it. We're an unusual city and district. We have a city school liaison.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Committee, which... you know, some questions are coming up or some points of interest or something like that, they can talk and they can report back to the two governing bodies. And I think all in all, that could have, you know,
stopped a lot. Because I know when we first talked about it, Bob Jenkins, matter of fact, when we were getting this off the ground, we didn't have personal computers in the city then. He had one. And basically, financially, I went over and designed the whole project on his PC, on his Lotus program, because I couldn't get at one here. And I had to do this projection out to see if what the numbers we were being told would generate. And one reason we had to wait a long time to sell bonds here is because we had to wait until the project grew to a size where it was throwing off enough tax revenue to sell.
To pay for the bonds upon payments,
which is why we waited until this time 3 years later. But meanwhile, all the money that came on, like when Target was built, when Mervyn's, when all these little stores were built, that was all passed through. We didn't keep, I think last year was the first year we captured.
So I think that there's one other really major point here that we should talk about, just briefly touch on. And aside from the cooperative nature of this whole thing between the school district and the developer and the city, and the way everybody worked to make this thing happen instead of fighting one another, which is typically what you might find in other cities. The other thing that really made this thing happen was having a developer, Stewart, that was able, willing and able to invest front money in the thing to make it happen.
Yeah.
We had many developers that came to us and said, well, I'm interested in making something happen, but when it came to providing any monies and spending even a buck, no, they wanted the city to come up with the money, and they would ride along. We didn't have any dollars, and I think we're proud to say that never was $1 of the taxpayers' money put into this thing, except for, if you want to count my time and Terry's time and the time of the city officials.
Yeah.
But as far as any cash payments, there never were any.
Well, what you're saying, if it hadn't have been for Stuart Franco, or someone, if you could have found another person with the same foresight as he,
right,
this would have never got off the ground.
That's right.
It was a pure chance coincidence. He built that building in our town, the original building, and Tim... pointed the project out to him
he was up to a challenge. A lot of guys would have said, hey, too much hassle for me, and walked, but he loved it. And Stuart says today, when you ask him about it, you get him thinking about it, he looks back and he says I'd do it all over again, because he just loves a challenge.
He must have liked the city when he put that first building in.
Well,
excellent scenario, at least for me, and you bringing me...
You know, I'd like to say, latter part of 40s, early part of 50s, when it was a township.
Yeah.
I was on the police department. We were instructed to have condemnation signs in our scout car.
It was 64 the project and 33 against it, and I think that's what...
So it was about a two to one.
It was 2-1 overall.
All property owners and not just the residents.
So.
I've got a question to ask you. Is those of us that are now on the TIFA committee.
Yes.
What? I don't see that there's going to be much activity for us.
No. There's really the activity, the great amount of activity, and Bernie will remember this, was back in 85 and 86 when we were getting started. There was a lot of meetings because we had to have public hearings when the condemnation was going. We had to approve a lot of expenditures as far as, because money was flowing through it. Pretty much there was an awful lot of meetings. And once it was condemned, which was I think in February of or March of 87 when they condemned, really, the great majority of the TIFA's work was done, and it was just a matter of waiting until this thing grew to the point to where we could sell bonds, which was the last remaining stricture contractual requirement we had.
And that's been completed.
And that's been completed a week and a half ago. We completed the closing, which there will be a communication out to you guys to explain. First of America Bank is the trustee for the bonds. Stuart got 2.9. We still held $1.4 million. There are two or three other accounts with monies in there to take care of Miller Canfield and various other people that were. These are minor type of things.
After these 10 families are taken care of,
which buildings are those?
Oh, by the way. Everywhere there's a little yellow sign, that's where one of the things is. That's where the property is.
That's our
map. And here's a more detailed drawing. But the way this is going to work is...
Those are the properties that were...
These are the ones that still are not settled?
Right.
Not
all of them. Well, a couple of those are settled.
Some have been settled. But those originally were where it was. But what's going to happen here is when a decision is made as to how much this owner should have received over and above, let's say some guy got $100,000 and they said, well, he should have got $125,000. what happens is Stewart has to requisition the TIFA to release $25,000. We have to authorize it, and I think it's something we can do administratively. I don't think we're going to have a meeting every time, although we would.
We can get signatures on that.
Well, myself and Tony are empowered to sign. But what happens is then we authorize First of America, who's the trustee, to release out of the construction account $25,000 to Stewart Prangle. And so...
And then Stewart uses that money to pay the judgment, and then that settles the matter.
That's it.
Assuming that there's a judgment now, it may be that they're gonna
they may do it on one fell swoop.
They may do it one action, and there may not be a lot of additional monies.
Are these individual cases, or are they getting together?
They're all together with one attorney. Everything that's left has one attorney.
Stanley Manrique and Ray Winnicke have that guy, used to have a guy up in Lansing.
I thought they were tossed out.
No. I don't think.
One or two attorneys.
One or two. There's two attorneys. But this one fella has most of them. I think probably if there's 10 left, he's got 8 of them. There's 2.
Yeah.
You know, this would make a great case study.
Yeah.
You know, it would.
Yeah. Well, there's a film now. We, in the beginning, wasn't it, Tim? We had the video cam the whole area before we took anything out. Because eventually we felt, and matter of fact, it's coming up, I think we have to have that film ready, because it may be a factor in these judgments as to what these homes look like. Yeah. We have a video cam of that. I think we have a video cam of the last property being raised, knocked down, and taken out. And there, somewhere else there's some slides of the area.
We got slides.
There's aerial photographs and all that other stuff. So it would have made a real wonderful cable TV, city cable TV thing, to have shown the making of a project, but just something that didn't happen.
Wasn't the contractor quitting one time because of the rats, and no matter what, you have to actually forget.
We had to have bait. Every time we knocked a house down there,
yeah, they had an exterminator
to come out and
bait the house first.
They wouldn't work.
Yeah,
they're so bad.
With the rats and vermin. Because if you knock them down, they'd all run out and go to
somebody else's house.
Right. Yeah.
You know, so we had to bait all of those houses. They were real infested. So. Yeah. But all in all, in the long run, we feel it's a good financial.
I don't know. I think I was the instigator of you fellows giving us this scenario.
Yes.
I was just saying that I there appears not to be that much left for us to do on the TIFA committee,
except
to write it through. But I just wanted to get a handle on the background of it, that if there is, or if some of the neighbors or something like this, or some of the constituents ask me questions, how is it progressing? Or why did this have to happen?
Sure.
I now have a handle on how to answer.
You're right. It would make a good.
Well, there's still
a good story, and I think maybe it should be written up sometime by somebody who knows how to write well and put it together. I think maybe it would make a good paper for presentation. It might even be expanded into something more than a paper, but initially I think it should be written.
Have something in writing or preserved on this, because if someone ever writes a history of, of the city.
Yeah.
Well, some of the material about it, Bill has, do you know Bill Miles? I'm sorry. Bill Miles is a city librarian.
We met, I don't know if it was at Lampeter School. I couldn't have said your last name.
We met at the police bond.
That's it.
We're putting things away on this. Yeah. And we did a speech for the mayor that kind of recapped this, and how this tape will be put with that. And any of the other paperwork that Terry and Tim have on it, we'll put it in folder.
Yeah.
So we have a whole
there's quite a bit of documentation here. In fact, he's even got an aerial photo that I gave him of the neighborhood. I think it was 1966, before the project was even dreamed of, back when they were talking about constructing the Oakland Mall.
You know, I didn't realize until you mentioned that that second block up there, you said Chrysler Corporation bought
yep.
that?
Yeah.
So do they still own that, and then they lease out that, like their Chrysler dealership and that?
It's a Boot McInerney. Chrysler Corporation, it's called Abco Four Partnership Limited, and it's out of St. Louis, but it's Chrysler. It's their holding concern. They rent it, and Hoot McInerney owns the dealership, and he operates that there. Matter of fact, it's kind of a funny situation. We enlarged the streets coming down. That's okay, Bill. We enlarged the streets coming down into, I think, probably Brush Alger and Palmer. Or maybe Brush and Alger. It wasn't only Brush and Alger. In other words, those streets off 14 Mile Road, we widened and paved and all this. And all these businesses along here were assessed. Now, the great bulk of the assessment, of course, went down to some of the shopping center areas because they would benefit
to Stewart.
And to Stewart. But some of it was assessed against the dealership. Well, we sent the notices out because by law we have to notice everybody that's going to come to a hearing and, you know, about the assessment. So it was sent to Abco 4 down in St. Louis, and they have a lease agreement with Hoot McInerney that says that he's supposed to pay all taxes and assessments. Well, if they never sent him the notices, the road goes in, and the following year he gets a bill for $20,000. So he comes flying down. I had never met him before, but I understand why he sells a lot of cars. But anyways, he comes whistling into my office, and what is this? And he said, so I explained the whole situation. You know, as a matter of fact, I went to the clerk's office and showed him the letter, or a copy of the postcard that had gone to Abco for, you know, informing him this. So he says, oh, okay. 2 weeks later, he's back, and he's got the leasing agent from Chrysler with him, and he says, he comes into the office and he says to the leasing agent, now you're going to sit down here, and he's going to tell you why you owe me $20,000. So, anyways, on that, but that's it.
For the sake of historical accuracy, the people that were in attendance at the TIFA meeting held on August 28, 1991, were Terrence Herron, City Assessor, Timothy L. Moore, Community Development Director, Henry Gibson, member of the TIFA Board, and Bernie Travnicker, member of the TIFA Board.